Subway everyday value means many mouth-watering piled high favorites are $5 footlongs, like the fresh-toasted tempting meatball marinara. And made-to-your-order BLT, the $5 footlong anthem rolls on only at Subway, where great everyday value lives. Subway, eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
I had to call the world's greatest injury expert and my personal favorite injury expert about Kevin Garnett's knee injury, which has now lasted, I think, longer than the War of 1812. And there's only one man to call under these circumstances. He writes for the Baseball Prospectus, the Football Prospectus, the Basketball Prospectus, and when I get it up and running, the Hollywood Prospectus, Mr. Will Carroll. What's happening?
Hey, not much, and don't forget Puck Prospectus.
Come Puck on, Prospectus. Yeah. Oh, wow, I didn't know about that one.
Yeah, come on. Hockey's big now with all the big playoff game last night. As
yeah.
good as the Celtics series has been, the Penguins and the Capitals has been one heck of a series.
We're taping this on a Tuesday, and it's either going to run on Wednesday or Thursday. I'm just so confused by this Garnett injury. This is, I mean, he does need microfracture. Mm-hmm. He didn't tear an ACL.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he has not played for 3 months, and there's no signs of him possibly playing. I have never heard of a knee injury last this long that didn't have a specific diagnosis. Now, you told me through emails that there is a specific diagnosis and that this actually makes sense. So please explain this to our listeners.
This is a tough one because, you know, the knee, we've gotten so used to knees being, you know, a meniscus tear and you go in there and you clean it out and the guy's back in 2 weeks. Or you have an ACL tear and you're out for the year, but, you know, you come back. We're all waiting on Tom Brady to see how he does. And if you get anything complex, it's something like Peyton Manning who's out for a couple weeks because of the infection. But we understand that. When you start throwing in words you haven't heard before, like popliteus tendon,
yep,
it throws us off. We're not used to it. And that's why this one's so difficult. The fact is, because this is such a rare injury, not just in sports but all around, doctors don't really know what to do with it. They don't have a lot of experience with it. You know, it's seriously important to a basketball player. They can't unextend their legs. And by that I mean, just before you see anybody jump, and you can kind of play along at home, you'll kind of bend your knee, and then you'll extend it out and make that big jump. Well, it's that loading phase that the popliteus tendon helps with. I talked to some people about this injury. Beyond the fact that it's just painful, there's no surgery for it. It appears that it also avulsed a little bit. And I know you like the big words. Avulse just basically means where the tendon goes into the bone there on the femur, it tore away a little piece of the bone. So it's not really connected that well.
Ugh.
And if it tears all the way out, well, you can imagine how bad that could be.
So when they say that Garnett's knee, like he came back, he tried to practice, and they were like, yeah, it was still locking up and it swelled.
Mm-hmm.
The locking up basically means that because of this, oh man, I'm the master of the mispronunciation. This is going to get ugly. The popliteus tendon?
Popliteus, you're close.
Popliteus tendon.
You went with the Latin pronunciation there. That's okay. That's acceptable.
So his popliteus tendon, so every time he crouches, it locks into the crouch?
Well, it basically gives. I think what they're saying, lock, isn't, you know, when we think lock, it's like straightened out. He
right.
just kind of gives, and actually the bones, because remember, he's had knee problems before. He probably doesn't have intact meniscus. It's going to give a little bit. He's going to feel kind of a give and what might feel like a lock. It's going to be a pop, you know. It sounds almost like, you know, electric boogaloo with popping and locking.
Right.
You really don't want that with your knee. You don't want to have to think about it. When you think about these guys, you know, we joke about somebody being out there and being unconscious, but that's actually what these guys are doing. All their physical talent, all their experience playing the game has to be instinctual. You know,
yeah.
Nobody's out there thinking, okay, I bend my knees, I shoot my elbow. You can say all those things in practice, but you can't do it during the game. And if that knee is giving a little bit, if it's feeling like anything other than jump, which he's done how many millions of times in his life, it's not going to be right. And let's face it, you know, Kevin Garnett at this stage in his career needs to jump to be able to play effectively.
Yeah, and you're talking about it's a mental signal that is sent immediately as you're trying to instinctually react to whatever's happening. And every time you get that signal and you're saying, uh-oh, Rashard Lewis is driving the lane, I got to hop over and help. And your knee's going, no, no, stay here. Don't go. No, don't jump. And there's just no way you're going to be able to play. It's not like you're fighting through a bad ankle sprain or even like, you know, in Willis Reed's case, I'm just going to drag my right leg and play that way. I think once you get with the knee, it's there's some sort of weird mental thing where they're so afraid to make it worse and they don't understand it. And there's so many ligaments in there that you're just, your natural reaction is just going to not do whatever you need to do.
Exactly. And, you know, the swelling is the other key there. When it's swelling up, that means something's damaged. Your body swells up both as a reaction to the injury itself. It's sort of how it splints itself. You know, when you sprain an ankle, you roll that sucker over, it swells back up, and it gives you two signals. First off, the pain says, hey, dummy, stay off me for a while. And the swelling is basically to make sure that all the necessary nutrients and everything else gets down there to it so that it can start the healing process. The fact that that thing keeps swelling up and stays swelling up, it's difficult. This isn't something you can have, a painkiller and get through it. He can't just suck it up. This is actually a functional issue. And like I said before, jumping and playing in the NBA class basketball, just you can't get around it.
Well, why isn't there
Yao Ming?
why isn't there surgery for this?
Well, the problem is that tendons are what connect the end of a muscle to a bone. The muscles obviously are the motive force for our bones in our body. And every time you're moving, that muscle's contracting and extending, and the bones of our skeleton are moving. Tendons are difficult because at times there's not a great blood flow to them. It's a very awkward location. It's in the back of your knee. It's really difficult. Reattaching it, if it's in fact avulsed significantly, again, pulling away from the bone, they would have to go in there with screws. And if they do that, it's not going to be any better. It's going to be better in the long term, but he's not going to be back for the Celtics anytime terribly soon. Tendons are just very, very difficult to heal. You see, more oftentimes, you'll see the patellar tendon, which is on the other side. That's that big tendon that holds your kneecap more or less in place. You'll often see Achilles tendon injuries, which is the extension from the gastrocnemius, your calf muscle. This is just one that is so difficult because of the structure of the body. It's basically got to heal itself, or you've got to go in there with screws and put it back in place.
So basically, let me try to guess what the Celtics are thinking here, because this injury happened at the end of February, and you know, I still wonder if he secretly had surgery and they didn't tell us, so I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that. But so they're hoping, all right, we'll give it 2 months rest, and hopefully it will be fine. And now it's not fine. And now we're taping this right before game 5 of the Eastern semifinals. At this point now, wouldn't you say it's like a 5-6 month rehabilitation process if they do the screws in? So now we're affecting next season.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't they just have the surgery and say, screw it? That's what I don't understand. It's like they're holding out hope that miraculously this thing is going to reattach to his bone.
Well, I think what they're looking for is something of a two-step process. When the injury first happened, I'm not sure if they understood exactly how serious it was, but I'm sure shortly after that they had a concept. Almost any time you see this, and we see this a lot of time in baseball, and people still don't grasp this, you'll always see guys go out and do a rehab, and then they'll end up having Tommy John surgery anyway. And people are like, oh, why didn't they just do the surgery? Why did they waste those 3 months?
Yeah.
Well, the fact is, you don't want somebody cutting on you if you can avoid it at all. With a thing like the popliteus tendon, it's possible, even probable in some cases. Again, we don't know exactly how serious the tearing is there. It's probable even that it would heal up enough for him to play. Now, if you could have Kevin Garnett back, just let's say a 25% chance of having him back for the playoffs, that's a pretty good probability for you. If he comes back, you're going to be a better team. You've got a chance at the championship. So they're very likely to have taken that chance. Now, when it got to this point where they thought they'd have him back and he's not, it's a little less clear as to why they wouldn't go ahead and do the surgery. I think it would be that they think they can have him back for the start of the season next year, whether they wait a month or not.
Is that true?
I don't know. It depends. If it's just the tendon itself, He should be able to be back. If he needs the surgery, I've heard between 2 and 4 months for the recovery, depending on how the surgery was done and how he reacts. That's the other thing we don't really know with Garnett, is how he'd react and how it will change the mechanics of his knee. Anytime you're putting pieces of metal in there, you never know how they're going to react, especially at his age. This might be the time. The other thing that I've often wondered is whether he said, you know, I'm not having this surgery. I'm just going to walk away. Because, let's face it, he's had a pretty darn good career.
I don't think he's walking away from $55
million. No, that's a pretty good motivating factor.
Yeah, I think he'll limp around for $55 million. If it was 1 year, $10 million, maybe he talks himself out of it. But that's the interesting part about this is his extension has not even kicked in yet. He has his 3-year extension starts next year. So, you know, now we're talking about this guy who has 1,100 games on his odometer, who has a knee injury that you've described as rare. Is it a fluke injury or is it an injury that you get because you've played too many games and your knee gave out?
Well, I talked to two different people in the NBA, different teams. They haven't actually seen Garnett, and they said they've seen this type of injury before. They haven't seen it this serious. So we don't know exactly what he did that set it off, whether this was a long, chronic process that eventually got bad, whether it's one event that caused the tearing, which is what they both thought. But yeah, you never know exactly how this is going to be. You know, I didn't realize the extension hadn't kicked in. I thought this was the first year of it.
Nah.
It reminds me completely, in almost every way, of the Chris Carpenter extension with the Cardinals, where, they gave him a big load of money and immediately he went back to being hurt. You often see these extensions that go off into the distance. Sometimes you wish you hadn't signed them back when you did.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thinking with Garnett, well, first of all, they had to do something to convince him to actually agree to the trade. But also, this was a guy who had never had a serious injury and was in peak physical shape and worked out and got up at 5 a.m. and ran on the beach at Malibu and all that stuff. And, you know, I don't know if this was a fluke or if you think like the way this guy played day in and day out, every game was game 7 of the NBA Finals for him for 11 years. Maybe your knee is just not meant to go through that.
Well, no, it's completely foreign. You know, one of the things I always say, especially in football, is if you stop thinking of them as human, it makes a lot more sense. Yeah, they look like us and they have the same parts, but these guys are barely the same species as us. They're just an incredible, incredible athlete. The one other thing that a doctor pointed out to me when I first started calling around after we talked initially, he said, you know what this is? This is your Ripken complex here. And a couple of years ago, I pointed out that it started with Hideki Matsui, but it goes back to Cal Ripken. Now, Ripken had that amazing Ironman streak. Matsui had the same thing. Players like that who are healthy that long, there's probably a genetic component to it that we'll find out someday, but there's also just a great degree of luck. They've gone through their careers. Ripken went all the way back into Little League without ever having an injury more serious than a sprained ankle. When he started aging, when he didn't heal quite as quickly as he used to, he didn't know how to deal with rehab. He just did not know what to do. It's something that wasn't in his skill set, and we see a lot of that. These iron men get to a point, and they've never had to go through an injury. They've never had to go through a rehab. They've never had to play at less than 100%. And I think that may well be in play here for Garnett because he's had an amazing run of luck.
That's really interesting. So it's not like he's being a wuss. It's just that it's almost like he's the Terminator, and he's part of his face got ripped off and he's looking at himself in the mirror and he doesn't even know like how to process what happened. Like he's got this weird pain and his body has been indestructible. Well, why is my knee locking? I don't get it. You know what I mean? He's probably been the best athlete at every point of his life since he was age 3. So
you're absolutely right. You get a lot of this where, you can say to almost anybody, any woman if you ask them, the worst pain they've ever had is going to be childbirth. For men, it's always different. It usually involves some sort of hard ball going directly into a soft spot of their body. But the worst pain is, it's different for everybody. It's still the worst. If you're lucky enough that the worst pain you've ever had is stubbing your toe, worst is still the worst in your mind. And the body's going to deal with pain in a lot of different ways. Willis Reed came out there and played it far less than 100%. Some players go out there and pitch at 75, 80% every day. I'm convinced that Andy Pettit has never been better than 80% his entire career. And yet look at how well he's done over the course of that long career. Injuries are just a tough thing to deal with, and it's as much a mental aspect as it is a physical aspect for a lot of people.
I saw it happen with Pedro Martinez in 2001. He had never really had an injury, and his shoulder started to hurt, and it really did affect him. Like, he just, it wasn't one of those things where he learned how to pitch through it. Like, he just was discombobulated by it. And it took him about 2 years to really come to the realization that he's, okay, my shoulder's going to feel this way when I throw. I'll never feel the way I did in 1999, and this is what I have to do to stay competitive. And you know what I mean? He just, it took him so long just to make that mental connection in his head. That's what I wonder about, you know. You brought this up with Garnett. Now I'm worried.
Yeah, well, it takes you a while to get used to it. You know, Pedro had an interesting thing with that, is that his brother had gone through similar injuries. And, you know, there is a genetic component. You know, anybody with the last name of Drew is going to be hurt half the time, which is why a lot of people avoid Steven in fantasy. It's just one of those things. I'm sure there is a genetic component to it. Ramon had gone through shoulder and elbow injuries. Pedro had gone through elbow injuries before, but it took him a long time to get comfortable, to figure out that, hey, I can be maybe not, you know, Pedro in all caps, but he could still be a pretty darn good pitcher. And you'll see guys, you know, Frank Tanana. Everybody remembers him as the junk baller, but, you know, early in his career, he was a fireballer. Roger Clemens lost his fastball there at the end of his Boston career, and, you know, he made his own breed of adjustments, the legal one at least being learning a split finger pitch.
And don't you think that maybe was – and oh, before I say this, I'd like to throw myself into the people who can't deal with any sort of injury list. Even though I'm retired from athletics now, I was a big head case. Sprained ankle, I just didn't want to play. I didn't know how to deal with it. But anyway, some of these other guys that use steroids and HGH, it seems at specific points when their body was starting to maybe break down a little, and then they inject this chemical or they do whatever, and they feel superhuman again. I really feel like that was part of the appeal. It goes even beyond the whole, I want to put up big stats and get money. It was more about, hey, this is great. I feel good again.
Yeah, and you think about it. You made the point about Garnett being the best athlete on his team since, you know, probably about the time he started walking. And you're exactly right. Roger Clemens, gosh, if you've read Jeff Perlman's book, which I highly recommend, the psychological impact to this is so clear. This is a guy who had always been maybe not the best, but had driven towards the best. He was just had that internal rage to him. And if he found a shortcut, you know, I don't care if it was steroids, HGH, you know, cow urine, I think if he thought that would give him the edge, he would probably have done it. And there are a lot of players like that. I don't mean to be singling out Clemens there.
Well, Bonds is the best example because he had an awesome year in 98 and was completely overshadowed by Maguire Sosa. And Perlman wrote about this in the Bonds book. Mm-hmm. He looked at the landscape and he's like, are you kidding me? I've been the best player for the last 11 years and these guys do whatever they did and they capture America. Maybe I should start doing it. And that's what led to all the choices he made and the fact that his head doubled in size.
Yeah, you get all these sorts of impacts. And, you know, to bring it back to Garnett, we're not sure how he's dealing with this. You know, he's out there and he's cheering and he's wearing nice suits. You know, he actually looks, every time I see him, I start thinking, you know, I've never thought of Kevin Garnett as a coach, but I can't remember ever thinking of Doc Rivers as somebody that was going to be a coach. I remember thinking of Isaiah Thomas as being that guy, but whoops, I really screwed that one.
Yeah, I don't think there's no way to know. Hey, everybody who followed Isaiah in like the late 80s, early 90s was convinced, like he basically coached those teams. And it's weird that he didn't become a good coach. I never watched Doc Rivers like you and thought, that guy is going to coach an NBA title team someday. I don't think there's any way to know. Garnett, I think, would be a better assistant. The way he sticks out his jaw, I think it gets people fired up.
Yeah, he'd be like the assistant coach in charge of swagger and nice suits.
And intimidating other teams and all that stuff. You know, I was thinking about your job before we made the call and about how I don't think your job's as interesting 20 years ago. I think the HGH and the steroids and the way medical analysis has evolved and all that stuff. Remember back in the day, it's like, yeah, he blew out his knee. And that was the diagnosis. Now it's like we're isolating it down to the popliteus tendon. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, there are two things that remind me of that. The first is, you know, Alex Rodriguez and Alex Gordon and Chase Utley and all these others having this hip surgery. Just a year ago, these were being diagnosed as groin strains because that's how it presents. You know, it's a hip problem. It's internal. But the pain is actually on the medial side of the leg, and you wonder how many of these groin strains along the year were actually hip labrum problems. But now, because GE made a change in the magnet in their MRI, we can actually discover these and correct the problem, and these guys are all having amazing comebacks. On the other hand, when you look back, I mean, everybody always says, well, what if Sandy Koufax had had Tommy John surgery? Well, it was actually a shoulder, so it's kind of a moot point. One of the more interesting things I learned, Alan Barrow wrote a book about Bear Bryant called The Last Coach. Great read. If you haven't read it, you really should. But one of the things he talked about was how Namath had come down there. He was going to be this great player that was going to bring Alabama all this glory, but he was always hurt. And we've all seen that big giant scar he had on his knee. You know what the problem was?
What?
I always thought ACL. It was a meniscus. It was a meniscus. He had a torn meniscus. They opened him up, looked around, literally opened him up and, you know, peered into the knee and said, oh, here's the tear, and took the entire meniscus out, both sides. The meniscus is in two halves. But this same problem in 1984 was experienced and virtually in an identical location by another athlete we all know. 2 weeks beforehand, this athlete was hurt, had arthroscopic surgery when it was still relatively new. 2 weeks later, went on and won a gold medal. The athlete, Mary Lou Retton.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's stunning. That's something that is almost an iconic injury to Joe Namath. Today, you would miss 20 days on the DL. You know, there are NFL players that have had the surgery in season and missed one, maybe two games.
I did, you know, I just finished this humongous basketball book, and it's amazing how many guys just got derailed by injuries that now we'd be able to fix in 6 months. You could make a whole all-star team of guys who blew out a knee, and that's it. They took the ligament out, as you said. They made them play with that weird knee brace that had the hole in the front. And, you know, Tim Hardaway, I think, was the first guy that ever blew out his ACL and came back, like, even within 90% of what he was. And even he didn't have the same crossover anymore, but... Mm-hmm. Even you look at what happened to C-Web, if C-Web comes along 10 years later, maybe he plays 17 years. You know, you just don't know. And I feel bad for some of those guys. Hey, the greatest one ever for Boston fans was Bobby Orr. That's like one of the all-time what-ifs. This guy basically played four seasons in pain and then dragged his leg around for the other five and was still the best defenseman in the league and had knee problems that are so easily fixable now. It's depressing.
Yeah, it's amazing. Mickey Mantle is another guy that always comes up. But even more amazing is if you look 20 years forward, it's going to be even more stunning. And that's where getting back a little bit to the whole steroids, HGH, performance-enhancing drugs thing, you know, we're getting to the point where I'm talking to surgeons who are doing this sort of almost experimental stuff. You know, Xavier Nady of the Yankees, Takashi Saito now with the Red Sox are having this platelet-rich plasma injected directly into their ligaments. Okay, we've all been in college, needed beer money, and donated plasma. We've all done that. We know that process. But then they're taking the plasma, a giant 16-gauge needle, which, you know, you can actually see the hole. This isn't like your little, you take your kid and get a shot needle. Putting it directly into the ligament and injecting it. It's evidently extremely painful, but it looks to be working. They're talking about Navy going out on a rehab assignment inside the year. And going forward, stem cell therapies, cadaver replacements, there are all sorts of things. We're going to regrow ligaments rather than surgically replace them. 20 years from now, you know, the Terminator thing might be really true. You know, Yao Ming will be out there with a Chinese-built Terminator leg jumping around. He'll have, you know, an Arnold Schwarzenegger foot.
Yeah, you look at the difference in the 60s, dietary, terrible. They basically ate Johnny Rockets every night.
Yeah.
Cigarettes, smoked them.
Yeah.
Booze, drank it.
You always see Jim Leland in the dugout. Now, it just reminds me that, you know, not too long ago, it was Mark Grace or Mickey Mantle.
Oh, yeah. When I was researching my book, guys smoked at halftime.
Well, they still do that.
They went. No, the players.
Oh yeah, they still do that. It's just not cigarettes.
Oh, it's just I think Vlade Divac was the last guy who probably smoked a cigarette at halftime. But these guys, I have this Celtics picture of they're celebrating like the 1965 title or 64 or something. And it's a framed photo. It's really cool. It's Red Auerbach. He's got his fist pumped. It's all the guys in the team. And two of them are holding cigarettes.
Yeah.
And it's, you think like, wow, this was only 50 years ago that athletes had no idea that it was just absolutely terrible to smoke during games. In fact, I think the 1964 finals, Tommy Heinsohn just played out of his mind, and then Bob Cousy wrote a book about it, and he was like, the key to our success in 64 was that Tommy Heinsohn quit smoking 3 weeks before the playoffs. That was their key to winning the title, was that they talked Tommy out of the Marlboro Reds. But
Imagine smoking a pack a day and then going out and trying to play, you know, just at the Y?
No.
These guys are running up and down the court.
No, and granted, it was a different type of game, and they're not running as hard. There's a lot of more jogging and stuff. I don't think you could smoke a pack a day now and compete in the NBA, but you look at, like, dietary, you look at the change in smoking and all that stuff, change in sleeping, the fact that these guys fly charter instead of being crammed on a coach flight that lands in three different spots. Then you look at the medical improvements. We might see somebody in the NBA play for 25 years at a high level in the next 20 years.
I mean, who will be the NBA's version of Jamie Moyer?
Yeah, well, I think John Stockton maybe could have done it. I think he could have played for another – he could have basically done what Moyer did. He could have been a backup point guard for another 5 years. But imagine somebody starting for 25 years. Like, could LeBron be the guy?
Yeah, exactly. You get so many of these, and we've also got, you know, the one guy I always go back to, he got such a bad rap and such a bad life, is Todd Marinovich, where they're basically growing these kids from the womb to be superstars. And we're seeing that now again with Tim Lincecum. You never hear about the kids that didn't make it, but, you know, we're getting to the point they're doing genetic testing to tell you whether your kid should be a basketball player or a lacrosse player. They're doing testing to tell you whether the kid's going to go to Harvard or community college. It's just such a stunning change. And, yeah, I can't imagine what it's going to be 20 years from now when I've got to, you know, instead of calling a surgeon, I'm calling a geneticist to figure out why some guy's DNA is off this week.
Yeah, I mean, even you've been doing it. How long have you been writing your column? For like 6 years, 7 years? 2002, so 7 years. So even in that 7 years, it's changed completely and totally and –
yeah, it's amazing how quick. I wrote an article, gosh, I think it was 2004, about labrums, shoulder labrums. It was virtually a death sentence for pitchers. And, you know, it keeps getting quoted, but I keep meaning to rewrite it because it's absolutely obsolete. The technologies, the success rate, it's just in as little as 5 years, everything's changed. And I'm sure it'll do the same thing in another five.
And I think the eyesight thing's been pretty interesting, too, like LASIK. Something as basic as that has really affected some of these guys.
Yeah, positive and negative. I mean, this is the first negative we've had with Brian McCann of the Braves.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to talk my wife into letting me have LASIK, and then now I've scared the crap out of myself trying to figure out all this stuff about why McCann has blurry vision and what they'd have to do to refix it. And actually saw a video that a surgeon sent me about how they could do it with a scalpel. And I was like, no. These glasses aren't so bad.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir. I have minus 10.0 contacts. Nobody has worse vision than me, and I would never do LASIK. Even the 1 out of 100 chance that the might go wrong, I'd be too scared.
I'm just worried, you know, holding your eye open and that laser shooting at me. I got visions of Blade Runner. It's not good.
Oh, it's killing me. So where do you see your job going, like, the next 5 years? What do you think is going to be the biggest story that develops?
Yeah, I think it's going to be stem cells. You know, stem cells have been a big political story for years because, you know, we've been told all these good things and all these bad things. And I think at some point it's going to be where we're actually regrowing things. The PRP therapy that Nady and Saito have had, actually Andrew Miller's having it for his oblique. And if we can figure out obliques, imagine how much we'll change the game.
And also awesome news for John Wayne Bobbitt.
That's true. And you've got these technologies that are coming where, you know, virtually everything, instead of, you know, taking this all the way full circle, heck, 5 years from now, we might be seeing them inject stem cells or platelet-rich plasma into Kevin Garnett's knee, and the popliteus tendon just basically regrows, and he's back out there in 2-3 games rather than missing all this time. The idea that we can do this is somewhat science fiction, But it's, you know, every surgeon I talk to, I wrote an article about the future of sports medicine last summer for Popular Science, and virtually every discussion we had came back to stem cells. It actually made for a tough writing the articles because I had to come up with different technologies. They didn't want me to just say stem cell over and over again. But
right.
It was absolutely amazing to hear, you know, Jim Andrews kept talking about, you know, he goes, I'm glad I'm old because in 10 years we're just going to have a guy with a needle and he's going to fix everything. And how would that change the game?
Have you ever met Dr. James Andrews?
Yeah, I've known Jim for quite a while. He's
you're on gym basis with him. Nice.
he's just amazing. You know, it's literally there are a few of these doctors out there now who are rock stars. When you talk about Frank Job, who originally did Tommy John surgery, or Lou Yoakam, who's now the lead, or Neil Eletrosh, who is also out at Curlin Job in L.A. and did Tom Brady's knee, and that's where a lot of people first heard of him. But yeah, there are these rock star doctors who, Jim was just at the right place at the right time and was forward thinking enough to say, hey, you know, this arthroscope thing might work out for athletes. And he was bold enough to go out there and find some clients and have some good early success. But yeah, I mean, it's just amazing how much these doctors are like the athletes at this point.
I've been pushing to run ESPN for like 7 years and they just won't give me the car keys. If it ever happens, Dr. James Andrews immediately getting a reality show. How good would that be? I want to know what his complex is like. Maybe we'll stash a couple of hot nurses in there to kind of sex it up a little bit. But each show would be, oh, yeah, this week Alex Rodriguez is going to come in and see how his torn labrum is. And as the deal, these guys would have to agree to be on camera. And why wouldn't they? Because Dr. James Andrews is the best doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll have to sign the paper. And now each week I have a star athlete on my show who's at this weird critical point in his career, and Dr. James Andrews is going to solve it. Be like Quincy.
Oh, yeah, and I can be like
you could be the Asian guy. Sam.
Well, no, I could be like Doug Llewellyn was on the People's Court. Just
oh, yeah, that'd be good.
and have you doing the voiceover. It'll be awesome. No, actually, you know, his new complex down in Pensacola, everybody, I'm having to have a hard time because I always just used to say pitchers headed to Birmingham. And, you know, fans everywhere would cringe. And now, because he's spending part of his time down at the Andrews Institute in Pensacola, I could tell you stories about his boats down there that would just stun you.
Yeah, that's a wise move by him. He even should have gone a step further, maybe gone South Beach. Like, he could have had his hotel, his clinic could have been right next to the Delano Hotel or something.
To really
entice the guys to come to him.
He's not that kind of guy. I mean, he's... The problem that you always have is when you first meet him, the immediate person you think of, because he's got that southern drawl, is Foghorn Leghorn.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And you're thinking, like, southern accents are cool when they're, like, telling redneck jokes, but not so much when they're telling you about surgery.
Yeah.
So it throws you off a little bit, but the guy's just got this confidence about him. Andrews is just sign me up for that show. I would certainly watch it.
I might have to write a column about just me going down there for a consultation with him. I don't really have any major ailments with my body, but maybe I do. Like, I have bad back. Maybe he could. Does he look at backs?
He does look at backs. I mean, come on. We can get you out there and throw some. One of the most amazing things, and this is one that maybe not everybody will grasp, but the most amazing thing about Jim Andrews is that he's the team doctor for both Alabama and Auburn.
What?
Yeah. I mean, you can't be both. You know, there are shootings every year around the Alabama-Auburn game, and here's a guy who literally will walk from one side to the other and change hats. He'll stick the other one in his pocket. It's the most amazing thing you've ever seen.
That's great. I love the fact that you call him Jim. That's so good. I mean, that's so much cooler than just dropping Aaron Schatz's name. Or I'm trying to think of somebody else. Or Nate Silver now is like mega celebrity.
Yeah, exactly. Me and Joe Sheehan have talked about having a shirt that says, I knew Nate Silver.
I was going to book him on a podcast, but I don't deal with PR people, and I'm too afraid to approach him. Now it's like trying to get a podcast with Obama or somebody. It's unbelievable.
Well, it's crazy. You know, there's this thing, this conference, this TED conference. Have you ever heard about this?
Yeah.
It's like all the movers and shakers, and they've got a podcast where you can see some of the videos from their conferences. And, you know, I've subscribed to the podcast right next to yours, and it pops up on my Apple TV the other day. It was like Nate Silver talking about race. And I was like,
wow.
Really? Wow.
Nate Silver.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think the reason that I really appreciate the prospectus guys is that you guys just attacked it from another way. And I know for me, you know, it definitely affected the way I try to write columns, because you just, you have to be factually correct. You just have to. You can't just throw out stuff and, you know, maybe when I'm writing columns, I think maybe in the past a few times, like, I'm so caught up in what I'm saying and how I'm saying it, how I'm presenting it and the angle, that sometimes it's not even lazy. You just kind of slip and you're like, yeah, I'll throw this out and I'll forget to look it up later. And then you hand it in. And I think you guys have really helped in that front. Like, no, you can't just say that Derek Jeter is a better shortstop than whoever, because boom, 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 and boom.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. And I just think it's made everybody smarter. Now, my fear is that it's almost made everybody too smart.
Yeah.
And now it's like, I'm honest, I'm afraid to write about baseball now, because I only follow the American League. And, you know, I watch every Red Sox game. I don't totally watch the other teams unless my fantasy guys are in there. I don't bone up on it. I'm not reading about it constantly. And I just feel like I'm not as educated to write about it as I would be about the NFL and the NBA. And in the past, maybe you could just say, yeah, screw it, I'll just write. But you just can't, not in this current climate, which, I mean, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's both. I mean, what you're talking about is kind of the Fire Joe Morgan syndrome, which was just the best website. I still cry every day when I think about going to that site and it's not there. And then I cry a little bit more when I see Parks and Recreation. it's one of those.
Oh.
It's
early. You got to give it. You got to give shows 15 episodes. 15 episodes.
So it's one of those sites where, you know, everybody thought they could do that, and you can't. But
no.
There is something of an attack climate on the internet where, you know, you have to be exactly right. I'm going to name drop here a couple anecdotes. I had an interview this morning with Bobby Thompson, you know, the Giants win the pennant guy.
Yeah.
And during the interview, I was actually talking to him. He mentioned something. I made two clicks on baseballreference.com and looked up to see whether he had actually hit two home runs during a game, as he said, or not. And the fact that, you know, you can have this wealth of information. I can remember being in college and having one of those old Big Mac encyclopedias, the Macmillan. You remember those?
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, you could dig through that thing all day and not find anything. Now, two clicks, and I find out that he hit two home runs in a game where Jackie Robinson hit one. Just absolutely amazing. And this morning, I was debating whether or not Dale Murphy should be a Hall of Famer with Chris Mortensen and Peter King on the Twitter. And I was like, I'm not sure Twitter is anything more than a fad, but that was just cool.
Yeah, Twitter's not a fad. I think it's going to evolve into something different than what it is now, for the reason that you just described, because it's possible to have a weird debate like that on Twitter.
Yeah,
I think the goods outweigh the bads.
Yeah, there's always going to be that guy who actually lives up to the old stereotype about living in his mom's basement and doesn't get out too much and knows far too many facts. And I think we are getting buried in facts. And it is one of the things you have to worry about at Baseball Prospectus, is that, you know, the Vorps and the Warps and the Pacotas, you can get buried in it and kind of get lost. And what you don't get from us is just how much we love baseball.
Yeah, Joe Sheen and I have had a couple really good arguments. Because he's a Yankee fan, too. A couple of great email arguments. Like, I threw out something about how we had this whole Edouard Ramirez email argument. And I was like, yeah, he sucks against good teams. And Joe comes flying back at me with like, well, if you look at his stat, and he's lists this whole larger list. And then I'm like, yeah, but I saw the two games that he didn't do well, and we kind of reached some sort of common ground. But you're not going to win a lot of arguments with the prospectus guys unless you have your facts in order.
Yeah, you got to have the facts in order. But I think it's interesting that, you know, we're having this whole old school, new school debate going. And I think it's everybody. You know, if you haven't learned how to use Baseball Reference, if you can't discuss, ESPN's doing it. It's kind of interesting to see how much they're pushing OPS this year on the baseball telecast. And you know, John Miller, who I love, is always saying, you know, OPS is on base plus slugging. Yeah. Like he's just, you know, cracked the atom or something. And it's interesting to see how something like ESPN, which, you know, was so new school 20 years ago, is a little bit behind, but trying really hard. And, gosh, you go play fantasy, and I can't wait for Pocota Fantasy Leagues, where we can just have Nate Silver tell us who wins in April.
I remember the first time Gammons dropped an OPS in a column. It was like watching Dad like wear a cool jacket for the first time. Like, oh, Gammons! Whoa! Settle down! It was pretty exciting. But I'm kind of probably in the middle, because I've always appreciated the stuff that everybody was doing. But at the same time, I still am probably closer to the old school sense that stats don't say everything. And I think, you know, there's a nice middle ground you can find. But we're, like, for instance, the Manny thing last year was a classic example of people just regurgitating whatever thought was in place, but not actually bothering to look it up. And we heard Manny quit on the Red Sox. And it's like, well, the stats didn't really say that. I wrote that in my column. And then Joe Sheehan, right around the same time, had a whole breakdown of, actually, this is a complete lie. Manny was the best hitter on the Red Sox in July. And that's a case where I think that stuff's really valuable, because you can't just throw out stuff and claim so-and-so and whatever. But it'll be interesting to see where it goes, because, you know, we've kind of figured out all the stats now. I mean, in basketball, I guess there's some stuff we haven't totally figured out yet. But in baseball, I think we're about where we are. I mean, I think where we are now is pretty much where we're going to be 10 years from now, don't you think?
I don't know. I mean, Gary Huckabee said analysis was dead, and it was something of hyperbole. And then, you know, about the same time, and he was making that same point that you were, that we're about as good as it gets, where, you know, tweaking the formula is going to get us, you know, minuscule percentages. But then something like pitch FX comes up, where you can actually see the pitches in three dimensions, where you can say, you know, he released it at this XY axis, and it broke by 12 inches and decelerated by 4% across the plate. And it's those things where I'm still getting my head around the fact that we can even do that.
Yeah.
Let alone try to understand it. And that's the thing. I'm still not sure it's a useful technology. I mean, gosh, it's cool. It's amazing to watch during the game and see these. You watch Barry Zito or Tim Lincecum pitch, and it's just this banana curve. And you think, oh, my God, that looks like a big loop in nothing. And then you see guys flailing at it because they can't hit it. It's just amazing. And, again, just like with medicine, I have no idea what's coming in 10 years.
What's weird is that some stats have gotten a lot of play mainstream, and then other stats that are really cool for some reason haven't. Like, for instance, I really think it's interesting, and this is something that we do if you're really into fantasy, if you're a total dork about it like I am. But you look at the luck ratio or whatever that stat is for pitchers. His stats were really good, but where did he have a lot of luck with line drives and stuff like that? And I think you look at John Lester this year, he's a perfect example of somebody that if you really closely examine last year's stats, they're a little fluky. You know, he didn't really fit the profile of a 21-6 guy. I'm not saying he's as bad as he's been this year, but probably somewhere a little closer to maybe 16-11 versus 21-6. I don't know.
Yeah, and you know, it's not just the stats; it's also the story. I mean, Lester is such a good story in such a big media market where they've got storytellers like Gammons and Nick Cafardo at the Globe. You know, they can really kind of spin things that'll, I don't want to say distract, but kind of confuse the thing, because the story is so good. You want to believe it. And that's where I think that stat heads have kind of lost people. You know, I can talk about VORP and WARP and Pocota and Luck
deep.
And Flake, and we've never done a very good job of explaining those. We don't have a guy, Joe Sheehan does a great job with this, of coming out and explaining exactly what it is. You know, scouts can always say, that guy reminds me of Joe DiMaggio. And you go, oh, well, I know what that looks like. And I can say, you know, this guy is like, you know, a 52 warp player. And everybody just kind of goes, go back to the basement. And
yeah,
I think that's going to be the change, is we're going to have to find an evangelist, somebody that can explain it. And Gammons has been a big step in that. You know, Prospectus wouldn't be where we are without that. You've been a big help, not just for baseball, but the football Prospectus, or Football Outsiders now.
Yeah, there's some Star Trek element to it that I think you're going to have to figure out how to shed. There's words and lingo that I think for somebody like my dad, who's just your average sports fan, he's just going to just hear it and go, I don't want to stay away. And I don't know how you cross that bridge. VORP, I think, is a really cool stat that I don't even totally understand. I mean, I do understand, but I wouldn't totally understand how to explain it, I guess, what I'm saying. You say value over replacement player.
Oh,
what does that mean, you know?
Yeah, it's great because, I mean, with the Red Sox, of course, it's an easy one. What's the difference between Kevin Youkilis and who is this Van Every kid they had there?
Jonathan Van Every, yeah.
Yeah. What's the difference? You know how good Youkilis is, and you know how absolutely replacement level Van Every is, right?
But here's the issue, though. With WHIP or with OPS, mm-hmm. That's something I could calculate on my own.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
With something like VORP, I'm trusting somebody else's calculation. You know, could I create a formula tomorrow for basketball chemistry or whatever and just claim that this is going to work and then write about it and people have to take that seriously? Like, where do we draw the line?
Well, yeah, I mean, ESPN tried that with productive outs. And
yeah.
We all see how well that took. I think you might have a bit more success with it. But yeah, you're right. VORP isn't something you can calculate, but it's something you can understand. When you get an example, like, you know, Youkilis is a very good player, possibly a great player, and then Van Every is your absolute replacement level. You find guys like him in Pawtucket every year. The difference between those is understandable. I mean, I'm stunned that Pakoda hasn't taken off better than it has because every scout does this. They say this guy is like that guy, and you know, it's always a Hall of Famer. It's never another
yeah.
guy. And you know, this guy is Willie Stargell. You know, I keep saying David Ortiz's career path is now going to look like Willie Stargell's late career. And people go, oh, okay. And I don't have to explain why wrist tendon sheath.
I'm ashamed to admit I skipped Pakoda. Maybe I'll have to really take a look at that. It's one of the ones that I'm just like, I don't want to clog my brain. But as I was working on my NBA book, and one of the things I kind of realized was that the arcs of the careers were very easy to kind of predict once you looked at enough of the old careers.
Yeah.
And for instance, yeah, I spent this whole summer just trying to figure out who were the best players and blah, blah, blah. And eventually I came to the realization like, wow, the Suns are screwed with Steve Nash. He is on the downside of his career. Nobody knows this yet, but this will be the year that his stats start to slide because I'm looking at John Stockton's stats. I'm looking at Gary Payton's stats. I'm looking at number of games played. And he's reached some sort of a tipping point that I can't fully describe, but this will be the year it starts to slip. And it did. I did the same thing with Tim Duncan this year. Looked at what happened with Kevin Garnett's stats last year. He had the oblique, but his rebounding went down. And I figured out, is 1,000 games right around there, something happens to these guys? Like if they're playing for a big guy, maximum level? And Duncan slipped this year. I looked at Jermaine O'Neal. Everyone was like, oh, big comeback year for Jermaine O'Neal. I looked up all the big guys, you know, that had been 2010 guys in the past. There was just no track record of these guys getting it back. So why would Toronto think Jermaine O'Neal got it back? So anyway, the point is, I do think that as this evolves, as we run out of ways to evaluate things in present time, I think people are going to start to use history and careers that have already happened to try to figure out the current careers.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if we could just get Nate Silver to stop doing this stuff like, you know, elections. Who cares about that? We got to get him working on basketball.
Yeah, and I think Pakoda actually could work better with the NBA.
Yeah, we did a little bit of that with the college basketball prospectus this year, and we'll see where the pro goes. It's tough. You know, obviously, everybody knows Aaron Schatz and the work he's done with his system, Kubiak.
Yeah.
So I think your task, Bill, is going to be figuring out which mediocre player we name it after.
For football, or would it be could
no,
I do any sport?
It's Kubiak for football.
Oh, for basketball, it's got to be Tim Thomas.
Thomas is an easy one. We need somebody with a you know. I always wanted to have Nate redo Pakoda and name it Bianca Lana just to try to see if we could come up with an acronym for that.
I see. So you're going with some sort of a catchy.
Yeah, we need some. Who is that guy that wrote the 12th Man book?
Paul Shirley.
Shirley
well,
might work.
He would be a VORP. He would be more of a VORP stat.
Okay.
For Pakoda. I'll have to think about that one. I'll tell you, Joe Prisbilla is a pretty good candidate.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Call it a Prisbilla.
Yeah, but that would work.
Yeah,
it'd
that's
be fun
pretty
to
good.
See Brian Kenny try to say the Prisbilla.
All right, well, congratulations on all your success and all the good stuff you guys are doing. As you know, I'm a champion of the prospectus sites. I think you guys do great work. And hopefully the basketball prospectus thing, it seems like it's become a site that I've started to check out. I still think we're a couple years away. We need more info. We need the teams to give us more info, or we need to figure out a way to assemble more info, but headed in the right direction.
It's funny because, you know, basketball might be behind on the stats side because the teams are ahead. You know, one of our biggest problems at Prospectus is that we keep finding good people and the teams keep taking them from us because they throw big checks in front of them.
Yep.
And it's tough because guys like Dan Fox, who's working for the Pirates, or Keith Woolner, who's working for the Indians now, those guys, it's tough to find those guys. You just don't find those kind of minds. Daryl Morey, Sam Presti, all those guys have guys like that in their front offices, and those are the guys that would normally be writing the Prospectus-style stuff.
Well, at the Sloan Conference, Daryl made an interesting point because he said the question he gets most asked is, how do I get to where you are? And his advice that he gives to people is, don't just come up with the same kind of stats that we're doing. Take me in another direction. Like, for instance, he said, the thing that we're now trying to figure out, because we figured out almost everything we need to figure out about the NBA, because they have all this wealth of information they don't share. But the stuff we're still trying to figure out is how to translate European production, how to translate college production, and even high school production, AAU production, whatever. That's the stuff that he feels like maybe you could break new ground in. The European stuff's really interesting, because that's something that nobody has even really tackled.
Yeah, especially with Rubio coming over next year.
Exactly.
There's so many things. And then, we talked about it at the start just a bit, but at Puck Prospectus, we're doing the same thing. There are almost no advanced stats for hockey. So every time we open our mouths, we're breaking ground just because we can.
Yeah, I noticed this year, watching the playoffs this year, like hits. See a lot of the hit stat.
Yeah.
It's got five hits.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, the funny thing is, having grown up around the game and being a goalie, it turns out our stats show that the MVP shouldn't be Ovechkin, it shouldn't be Crosby, it should be Tim Thomas. And that just makes my heart sing.
Yeah. Well, I any Bruins fan could have told you, you need the hot goalie. We got knocked out of the playoffs a few years by the other teams. We never really had the hot goalie in my lifetime. That's why we never won a cup. Anyway, Will Carroll, thank you very much for clearing up the popliteus tendon. Popliteus?
Popliteus.
Popliteus. Thank you for clearing up Kevin Garnett's popliteus tendon and everything else.
I wish I could make it clear up, but thanks for having me on, Bill.
All right. Take care.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
You laughed, you cried, you turned up the sound repeatedly, and now it's all over. This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just-breaking news.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
The $5 foot-long anthem rolls on with Subway Everyday Value. So many of your Subway favorites are $5 foot-longs, like that Tastetacular Spicy Italian $5 foot-long and the piled ridiculously high BLT $5 foot-long, both made to your order on the freshly baked bread of your choice.